This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, a career educator explains what he thinks is wrong with the wave of education reform sweeping the nation. But first, there's another kind of reform that's gaining momentum in the U.S., a move toward a minimum wage of $10.10 an hour. First proposed by President Obama, it's now part of Governor Daniel Malloy's plan for Connecticut. That proposal is a big part of the reason why U.S. Labor Secretary Thomas Perez came to Hartford yesterday to meet with members of the state's congressional delegation and business leaders to promote the increase. Secretary Perez joined us by phone shortly after that press conference ended. Secretary, welcome to Where We Live.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Why did you bring your message about the minimum wage to Connecticut?
Well, you have great leadership at a local, state, and federal level, and we were here today to listen directly to businesses and to low-wage workers talk about the need for Americans to get a raise. Connecticut has so many remarkable people who are working hard but falling behind because $7.25 just doesn't get you very far. The purchasing power of the minimum wage is about 20% less than it was when Ronald Reagan was president. So imagine taking a 20% pay cut every single day when you're coming to work. And so we had a very active and robust conversation. We met business leaders who support this. We met workers who told their stories, and we're going around America because this issue has really taken off. I've been all around the country, and frankly, red states, blue states, anything in between. There's overwhelming bipartisan support of the American people for increasing the minimum wage because they recognize that nobody who works a full-time job should have to live in poverty. And regrettably, here and across the country, that's happening, and that's not America.
Connecticut has already acted to boost its minimum wage. Now, our governor, Daniel Malloy, wants to follow the president's lead and enact legislation that would eventually get Connecticut's minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. Is this something that the states could handle themselves? Certain states are maybe more affluent than others, more able to make a minimum wage increase like this over a short period of time. Do you think it could be left to the states and not have federal oversight?
Well, there has always been a remarkable synergy between the federal government and state and local governments on this. The federal wage should be the floor. 75 years ago, FDR signed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which established a minimum wage for the first time. And it was based on the notion that when you work hard, you should get a wage floor. And it was really a judgment that we should reward work with a fair wage. States have always been permitted to go above that. Connecticut has, and that's a reflection in no small measure, recently especially, of the leadership of Governor Malloy and so many others in the state Senate. Connecticut's also been a leader in the area of paid leave, and I saw a survey recently of employers who indicated that they supported the notion of paid leave because, again, it's about fairness. And so the combination of a federal floor and states going above it, that is how the minimum wage has worked, and it's reflected the fact that the cost of living in Connecticut is a little bit different than the cost of living in Alabama. But we should always have that floor, and that's why the federal efforts underway are so critically important.
You talked about meeting with business leaders here who are supportive of this change. Many others in the business community have not been, and they and some of the Republican Party have seized on this report by the Congressional Budget Office just last week, saying that total employment in the U.S. could be cut by some 500,000 workers in the second half of 2016 if indeed these changes go into effect. What do you say to those in the business community and those across the aisle who are concerned about the impact this will have on jobs?
Well, I read the CBO report that you referred to very carefully, and the report highlighted that raising the minimum wage to $10.10 would help 24 million people directly or indirectly, and also would help roughly a million people climb out of poverty, and would infuse $19 billion into the economy. And by the way, when people get this money, they spend it because they're living paycheck to paycheck. On the issue of employment, the CBO had a range of estimates, and ranging from no effect to up to the amount that you had described. I think it was 0.3%, something like that. And what's interesting to note is that Economists have studied this issue very, very carefully, and they've looked at jurisdictions. For instance, New Jersey and Pennsylvania, right across the bridge to Philadelphia, there was one jurisdiction that had raised the minimum wage and one that had the lower minimum wage. So economists studied the impact on employment in that jurisdiction, and they found that it had no impact on employment. And then the question was asked, and it was a fair question, well, that's just one jurisdiction. Why don't we study the whole country? And so they looked at roughly 450 different jurisdictions across the country doing the same study, where there were differential minimum wages in areas that were right next to each other, again, testing the theory that, well, that the jurisdiction with the higher wage should have more employment loss. And the answer was, no, they didn't. And that's because, as we heard today from employers, when you pay workers a fair wage, you have much less attrition. You have a much more loyal workforce, a much more efficient workforce. And that is how it's a win-win situation. And when you pay workers a decent wage, they have more money in their pocket, so they buy more. And that is huge for people. And that's why this is, you know, the issue of employment impact. I think there were 600 economists, who, including seven Nobel laureates, who concluded that increasing the minimum wage would have little or no negative effect on the employment of minimum wage workers. So this really is, I think, a win-win situation. And I hear that from employers everywhere I travel.
Thomas Perez is Secretary of the U.S. Department of Labor. He visited Connecticut to talk about the minimum wage proposal. Thank you so much, sir, for giving us some time. I appreciate it.
Have a great day.
Coming up, East Lyme Superintendent James Lombardo, a longtime veteran of Connecticut's public schools, will weigh in on changes within the state's educational system, something he recently outlined in a letter to Governor Daniel Malloy. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Education reform has been the topic of an increasingly angry conversation online between those who support teachers and those who support accountability. The new Common Core state standards and a teacher evaluation system being rolled out at the same time forced this issue to a head, and the Malloy administration recently backed off its plans to implement teacher evaluations right away. But for East Lyme Superintendent James Lombardo, a longtime veteran of Connecticut's public schools, a slowdown or revision of this plan isn't enough. He says education reforms are heading the state and the country in the wrong direction, and he said so in a letter to the governor and to Education Commissioner Stephen Pryor. We talked to Superintendent Lombardo by phone yesterday. Welcome to Where We Live.
Well, thank you very much.
We read your letter to Governor Daniel Malloy with quite some interest, because this is a subject that we've been covering, obviously, for quite some time, and there are impassioned voices on both sides of this issue. We haven't, frankly, heard from too many superintendents of schools in our state who are expressing some of the skepticism about educational changes that you have in this letter. So I'll ask you first why you decided to write this letter to the governor.
Well, I actually have written several letters to the commissioner and governor over the past couple of years expressing my concerns with the reform agenda. And I decided, after reading the recent report about flexibility that was being offered for the next couple of years and seeing some of the rationale for it, that it was really time to speak out publicly, especially now that I'm in my final year as a superintendent of schools. And I've also had a lot of experience working on educational policy as well as assessment reform in both the state of Connecticut and also in the state of Vermont and Pennsylvania. So I've got some real opinions about this, and I think they need to be said.
From the opening paragraph of this letter, you write, "I've been a lifelong Democrat, convinced that the Democratic Party had always supported educators and education much more than the Republican Party. I am saddened to find that I will now leave the profession I love after 43 years, convinced for the first time in my career that my state, nation, and political party have adopted educational policy that is harmful to children." So that's obviously something that many people who are lifelong Democrats and believe, as you have, that Democrats are on the right side of educational reform, that's something they're not going to love to hear. When did this begin to come into your mind, Dr. Lombardo, that indeed your party was doing things in education that you just didn't like anymore?
Well, my concerns about my party in terms of education are primarily at the state and federal level. I began to be very concerned when President Obama was first elected and we shifted from the No Child Left Behind policies of his predecessor to a new agenda called Race to the Top, which kind of emerged in the midst of the federal government trying to look at the reenacting the public policies related to education at the federal level, which really haven't gone anywhere in the last 4 or 5 years. But the administration has certainly instituted some significant reform initiatives, kind of captured under the umbrella of Race to the Top, that have, I think, seduced states into adopting policies that haven't been well thought out and are actually doing harm to the education profession and to children.
Do you think it's that the policies themselves are primarily not well thought out, or do you have more of a concern with this type of top-down directive coming from Washington, given that all towns and cities in the United States are so very different in their educational needs? Are you more worried about the top-down nature of this coming out of Washington, or about the policies that they're espousing themselves?
Well, I'm not sure you can completely separate the two, but my main concern is that I don't believe that the public policies that have been developed regarding the Common Core, regarding teacher and principal evaluation, and regarding student testing have been very well thought through. I don't believe that they're based on sound assumptions. And the letter that I wrote to the governor and the commissioner in particular really challenged some of the underlying assumptions of this pretty extensive policy. And whether or not the federal government ought to be initiating it is really a political question that I'll let others argue.
And we're going to go through in this letter that you wrote to the governor, the commissioner, and others some of the ideas that you have about this. But I'm wondering if you can first address where you think this type of reform that we've seen from the Bush administration, then into the Obama administration, the type that the Malloy administration is certainly pushing, where this idea comes from. What problem in education do you think, sir, they're trying to solve with these reforms?
Well, it's no surprise to educators that much of the reform agenda that's emanated from the federal government has come out of a concern about international tests of mathematics and science. In fact, those tests go back to 1964, the year in which the United States participated in the first international test of mathematics and science. At that time, it was known as the First International Mathematics Study, or FIMS. And in that particular year, there were 11 participating nations. The U.S. scored 10th out of those 11 developed nations. And yet, as the author Yang Zhao in his book Catching Up or Leading the Way very clearly articulates, that in a study that followed the release of these data, Keith Baker, a retired officer of the U.S. Department of Education, looked at the relationship between the results of those first international math studies and the 11 participating nations' success in terms of national wealth, rate of growth, individual productivity, quality of life, livability, democracy, and creativity 40 years later. And in short, what he found was that the higher a nation's test score 40 years ago on the original FIMS, the worse its economic performance has been over the next 40 years. There are tons of measures that show that the U.S. has been very successful as a nation in spite of the fact that we scored poorly on international tests of math, science, and now in reading.
So how do you account for that? Is it that the tests themselves aren't accurately trying to figure out what makes someone good in math or science? Or is it that essentially, the educational systems of the countries that do well, we're missing something about creativity and the very things that seemingly have made America so prosperous over the years?
Well, I do think that what's missing in this new reform agenda is the recognition that the creativity and initiative and the American spirit over the last 60 or 70 years since the first international tests have really resulted in an incredible economy and an incredibly successful nation. In fact, there's studies that show that that in terms of world patents, the U.S. not only ranks number one, but we rank number one even in China. So, I think it's that tests there is no test that has the power or should be given the power to be the motivator for serious decision making about individuals or public policy. They can inform it, they can give us some ideas about it, but they certainly shouldn't be the primary decision maker for those types of things. We can cite thousands of examples of very successful people and very successful product development in this country that has absolutely no connection whatsoever with the test performance of those individuals or the groups of people that put together those products.
Another important thing that many might raise, though, is that while our overall test scores may fall somewhere in the middle of the pack or down near the bottom when it comes to test taking, and that may send off alarm bells for some, rightly or wrongly, there is this reality that in America we have this gap between people who perform well in school, not just on standardized tests, but perform well at all in school, and those who perform very, very poorly. This achievement gap that we've heard so much about is seemingly a bigger problem in America than it is in many other industrialized countries. Do you think that that's part or a big part of what reformers are trying to get at, closing the gap for those very, very poor performing students in cities and towns like Hartford, Bridgeport, New Haven, and elsewhere in the country?
Sure, and it's a very noble goal. It's an important goal, and I laud the governor and the legislature for recognizing that as an important problem in Connecticut. I just simply think that the public policy that came out of that recognition was wrong. It's targeting a problem with the wrong solution. I think that, yes, poverty is at the basis of all of the problems in terms of our education. There's a ton of research and literature that's been written over the last 50 years. Going back to some of the original studies that were done in some of the schools in Baltimore back in the 60s, and we can find that poverty is always at the root of educational problems, and those need to be addressed. Public policy needs to improve in terms of the way that it deals with the issues related to poverty in our cities. But to create a public policy that is aimed at a problem that is localized by making the entire state and every community in the state follow the same practices is misguided. And it's setting up a solution. It's setting up problems for school districts that didn't have these problems before.
We're talking with Superintendent James Lombardo from the East Line Public Schools. He wrote a very comprehensive, compelling letter to Governor Daniel Malloy and Commissioner Stephen Pryor and others about education reforms in the state and some of the problems and solutions he sees moving forward. And we're talking about this as we get ready for a panel of teachers tonight in Hartford at our facility here on Asylum Hill. We're going to be talking about some of these very same issues. If you want to find out more, go to our website, WNPR.org. You lay out in this letter what you call inherent policy flaws, and we've discussed the first one, this first assumption that low test scores indicate a failed school system. The second assumption that you point out is that, you write, a more rigorous standardized test will give us information that we need to make better high-stakes decisions such as student promotion, college entrance, and employee advancement and tenure. You say that this just isn't true.
Well, I say that it's a flawed assumption that anyone who develops tests, in fact, if you get a test maker from any major test organization in a room and ask them privately, should this test be used to make high-stakes decisions for individuals? And they will always tell you that it should not, that this is one test, one day in a child's life or in an adult's life where they are performing on a single set of indicators, narrow as they may be. As you know, any test design requires choices. It requires choices on which objectives are going to be attended to on the test, and there are limitations in terms of the number of items that can be used to assess how well a student or an adult does in a particular area. And the smaller number of questions that you have related to a particular objective, the more questionable the outcome of that is. You can get a broad picture of how a student does in terms of reading, math, science, and writing, but that test should not be used to make high-stakes decisions in terms of what courses a student would be able to get into, whether or not a student is promoted, whether or not a student gets into a college or university. Colleges have been recognizing this for a year. There are many institutions, including the entire state of California, that has really stopped using the SATs as a determiner for whether or not a child gets admitted to school. They recognize this is one test at one moment in time in a child's life, and it shouldn't be used for these kind of high-stakes decisions. There's lots of other elements that ought to be used when making those kind of choices. So, yes, I do believe that using a single standardized test to measure either a student or a teacher's performance is wrong.
Your third assumption comes to one of the most interesting things to me about these reforms. It's the idea of motivation, that whether it's testing a teacher on his or her performance or testing a student on his or her performance, that somehow or other their role in this high-stakes testing game is going to motivate them to do better. 40-some years in education, you're not convinced that actually does motivate people to do better.
No, I'm actually convinced that motivates them to do less well. I'll give you some examples. We are finding in our school district here that the entire reform agenda is having a negative impact on morale in the district. And what we're finding is that rather than teachers increasing their levels of attention to student test performance, it's causing them to really make choices in terms of the learning objectives they select and the benchmarks they identify so that they will maximize their opportunity to do well on this assessment. It's just common practice. It's human nature to want to do well. No teacher wants to be rated as developing or underperforming. Everybody wants to be at least proficient, and certainly most want to be exemplary. And so that they are making decisions about which learning objectives to choose, which ways they're going to measure those, so that it maximizes their score on this final evaluation. At the same time, teachers know when principals are coming in to observe their classes and formal observations. They are now being familiarized with a very complex rubric. In fact, it's got over 30 different objectives, over five different domains that they're being assessed on. And they know which of those domains and what kinds of practices in the classroom will maximize their score in terms of the observations. So as human nature is, they will make sure they perform well at the time when their principal attends. To maximize the score. And in fact, if you look at the NEEC study that was recently done by UConn, looking at the first year of the pilot project for this teacher evaluation system by 14 school districts in the state, I don't remember the exact number, but it was over 80% of the teachers were rated as proficient or exemplary on this. In fact, I think it was closer to 90%. Very few were rated as needing improvement or developing. I think it was only 2% of the teachers. And that wasn't a whole lot different in my experience than we would have experienced with other evaluation systems. So if this system was intended to be much more aggressive and much more rigorous in terms of quote-unquote weeding out the bad teachers in our midst, I don't think it's working.
Well, I'd like to ask you about that because I've asked a number of people over the course of the years having this conversation about this issue of so-called bad teachers. Many people in the education reform movement say that one of the biggest problems in education today is that there's no way to weed out the truly bad teachers, that work rules having to do with employee unions keeps bad teachers teaching kids, and that is causing a problem. But whenever I ask the question, no one's ever able to give me a real good number of how many bad teachers are out there. So, again, you've been doing this for quite some time. Is there a percentage, sir? I mean, do we know how many bad teachers we really need to get out of the profession so that better teachers can be teaching our kids?
I do not think that this very cumbersome, costly system of teacher evaluation is needed in order to, quote-unquote, weed out bad teachers. I can ask any one of my principals if they have any teachers on their staff who they believe are not performing. And by performing in this profession means not doing harm to children in terms of the educational environment and not teaching in a way that results in student learning. I would view both of those as being harmful. And my principals can identify who those people are. And when they identify who those people are, we take steps, whether the person is tenured or non-tenured, to move that person out of the classroom and out of their position. Over the course of the years, my experience is that the problem is not that we have teachers who are underperforming. It's that we have principals who are underperforming and superintendents who are not paying attention to their to what their job is. And I would argue that unions are not keeping school districts from moving ineffective teachers out of the classroom. It is principals and superintendents that are making choices to believe that that's the case. My experience has been that if you have a poor teacher, you can, in a reasonable time frame, and I say within a year, move that teacher out of the classroom, tenured or otherwise. And I don't see Connecticut's tenure laws getting in the way of that either.
We're talking with Dr. James Lombardo. He's the superintendent of Eastline Public Schools. He's going to be leaving that position after some 43 years in education, 30 years in the district next year. And he's joining us to talk about a letter that he wrote to Governor Daniel Malloy and Commissioner Stephen Pryor about education reforms at the state and federal level. We've been going through some of the points that he makes. And this idea of the climate of the workplace is something that you address here. This mandated change coming all at once, and we'll get back to how quickly this change is all coming with the Common Core and some of these new work rules. But it seems as though it's already affected the climate of teachers, of perhaps students as well. Tell us a bit more about that.
Well, I think that the way it's really harming students is that it is taking up an inordinate amount of time on the part of their teachers and their school systems, and removing teachers for hours and hours at a time from the regular classroom to either learn about the Common Core, learn about the new teacher evaluation system, to do the paperwork required to do this. As an estimate, here's some of the time that's being taken away from our kids. 7 to 10 hours of testing in grades 3 to 8 and in grade 10. That's what this new Smarter Balanced Assessment program will require. 7 to 10 hours. That's the equivalent of almost 2 full days of instruction spread out, in many cases, over a month. Dozens of hours of lost contact time with the teachers for students as the teachers leave their classrooms for required training or planning and activities related to the Common Core, state tests, and teacher evaluation. We're losing thousands of dollars of educational resources as our schools spend very limited funding that we have on computers to accommodate the state tests, because these new tests require that every student sit in front of a computer screen and answer all the questions. We're purchasing new textbooks that are aligned with the Common Core. We're arranging all of our professional development to learn the details of the elements of this reform. Both the state and local districts are spending millions of education dollars at the state level on education consultants and out-of-state corporations to develop and manage very complex elements of the entire reform agenda. I got to tell you, there's nothing elegant about this reform agenda. It is cumbersome, it is complex, way beyond what the goals of it are, and is necessary for the goals that it are, that are in place. And there are much better ways to do this. I think it's costly. It's taking away time from teachers and to focus on creating engaging and exciting lessons for students. It is taking teachers out of the classroom for hours at a time. And certainly putting students in an assessment mode, both in terms of taking the test themselves, but also preparing for the tests. Because teachers, by human nature, want their children to do well on these tests. So in spite of the fact that I, as a superintendent, say to them, I don't want you spending a lot of time preparing for these tests, they do it anyway. They want their children to do well. They want their children to be successful on these tests, and so they spend time helping them prepare for them.
One of the things that's so interesting, as you just said the sentence, there are better ways to do this, and I want to get to some of your prescriptions for maybe more common sense ideas in education than some of the reforms that you clearly don't believe are working. But sometimes, sir, I wonder what problem we're trying to solve here. As we started, you said that really, we're spending a lot of time worrying about how we do on standardized tests around the world. Do you think that American education just isn't as bad off as we all say it is? I mean, do we need to be making massive changes of any sort right now? Or are there just some things along the edges that we could be doing to improve? It almost sounds from a lot of what you're saying that we're just not as bad off as we're making it out to be.
Well, I personally don't think we're as bad off. I do think that we've got some incredible problems in the United States right now, but they're primarily driven by inequities in terms of funding and resources for schools. And we also have lots of educational problems related to inequities in terms of the economic conditions that individual students come from. And we need to do a lot in terms of public policy to improve, particularly in the area of significant poverty in our country. But putting that aside, if you look at all of the evidence, I think there's a lot of it out there to show that the United States has done pretty well in terms of any measure of international success. We ranked number one out of 131 countries on the 2007-08 Global Competitive Index, which measures the ability of countries to provide high levels of prosperity to their citizens. It was developed by the World Economic Forum in 2007. The core innovations that drove the global revolution were created in the United States. We're the leaders in terms of computer and internet industry. We own nearly two-thirds of the 300,000 patents that were issued since 2002. In a report that was prepared for the U.S. Secretary of Defense and released in 2008, researchers at the RAND Corporation found that the U.S. continued to lead the world in science and technology, accounting for nearly 40% of the total world spending on research and development in these areas.
So there's a lot
of really positive things. So I don't think our educational system is producing educated people who are doing poorly in terms of their individual success as well as our nation's success. I do think there are a number of things we can do to improve education that are much more sensible, much less time-consuming, and much less costly. Should I share some of those?
Yeah, and I would like you to share some of those, but I just want to ask quickly, though, one of the things that, that we keep hearing is that at the college level, an inordinate number of kids are coming out of high school ill-prepared to do college-level work. This is something we hear at the community college level, the state college level, and even going into some very expensive private schools. And then we hear from people who are in different professional fields that the job candidates they're getting are ill-prepared to take the next step. While all of what you just said may be true over the course of the last several decades, is it possible that we are not preparing today's school children well enough for college and then a career as we have in the past, and that's a course we need to correct?
Well, I think if you look at the data related to college preparedness based on the number of remedial classes that students exiting high school and entering college need to take, I think you need to look at it in the context of the changes that have happened in the last 50 years. When I was a student in high school back in the 1960s, I graduated in 1967, high schools were graduating close to 60% of their population. There was not the expectation that everybody go to college. There were plenty of good-paying jobs in industry in this country, which could provide a very good middle-class income with very good lifelong benefits. My father was one of the beneficiaries of that system. He worked in the same job for his entire career, made a good wage at the time, had good benefits, which were with him for the rest of his life. Nowadays, we're graduating nearly 90% of our students in most school districts in the state of Connecticut. Those students, a very high percentage of those kids are going on to college, close to 85%, at least in my district. And yes, many of them 40 years ago would be going into business or going into a factory to work. Now they're going on to college, and so certainly there's going to be a number of them that can't read or write or do mathematics as well as their peers, and certainly they're going to need to take some, if you call them remedial classes, but certainly classes to boost their opportunity to do better in their college-level classes later on. So I think you need to look at those claims in the context of a much larger percentage of students who are going on to college now than ever before. Maybe some of the public policy decisions that we've made over the last decade in terms of opening up borders to economic development between the United States and other countries and some of these agreements that we've reached have actually harmed our ability to have good-paying jobs available for students who didn't go on to college. And maybe we ought to be looking at some of our public policies related to that because they're all interconnected.
And so before I let you go, let's talk through some of your educational ideas. What are the things we could be doing better right now that we're not thinking about, that we're not implementing at this point, whether at the state or the federal level?
Well, I do think that the I've got to end by saying that certainly I don't speak for the I speak as an individual superintendent with 30 years of experience in this particular position in multiple places. I'm not speaking on behalf of the Superintendents Association or even of my school district for that matter. But I will say that some of the practices that I think are very promising and that can be employed with a lot fewer resources and in a much more reasonable fashion could reap tremendous results, and there's a lot of evidence to show that they will. First and foremost, I think organizing schools in terms of the professional learning community model, whereby teachers who work with similar students, either the same grade level or the same subject area, work together to develop lesson plans, to develop common assessments that they can use to determine how well their children have learned a particular objective or goal, and to design lesson plans collaboratively and together to address the needs that those students might have. I'll give you an example in my old school district. For example, our second grade teachers in our elementary schools work together to develop lesson plans, to develop common assessments, to determine whether or not children have learned a particular objective. And then they move students around between and among teachers to address their needs. So if you have a group of children who didn't learn a particular concept, one teacher will work with them for a day, while the other teachers are working with the other students, moving them on to the next level. So there's kind of organizational changes that one can make, and you can also take advantage of the skills of multiple people to develop good assessments that can be used immediately. Not standardized tests, but good local assessments that can be used to make sound educational decisions on a day-to-day basis. There are also tremendous professional development practices that can be employed in school districts to boost teachers' skills. Teachers are always interested in doing a better job. My experience over the years is that there are very, very few teachers who don't want to improve in their profession. And so working with teachers to bring in speakers or programs to improve their teaching practices and their knowledge of certain subject areas is always a boost to students ultimately. There's also a lot of research that shows a variety of different practices that can work very well, and principals know what that research is. There is no research that says that creating a cumbersome, complex, and costly system of teacher evaluation is going to bring about improved student results. And the early evidence from other states that have been using these kind of systems that we're just getting into demonstrates that there really isn't much in terms of student learning gain that's being realized as a result of this. And there's a lot of money, time, and effort going into it.
You close your letter with this line: the Connecticut reform agenda does not need to be fixed. It needs to be dismantled before it does any more harm. When we talked on our program about the changes that Commissioner Pryor has instituted to, in a sense, slow down some of these reforms when it comes to teacher evaluations, the point you're trying to make, sir, is that it's not about slowing things down. It's about taking the reforms that we've put on the table here and completely dismantling them. Is that realistic in your mind?
Is it realistic in terms of the whole political movement that we're involved in right now, both at the federal and state level? Probably not. Probably not. But I do think that at the state level, particularly here in Connecticut, we do have the ability to step back and say, look, a lot of this reform agenda has been put into place because we believe that we will now be eligible for race to the top funds by doing so. The federal government says if you want to have a piece of this financial pot called race to the top funds, you need to buy into these agenda items. That's what we're seeing right now. Connecticut has not received one nickel from the federal government for race to the top funds, and we've been operating and putting this reform agenda in place now for 3 years. We have the ability to say, look, we haven't used these funds. We haven't needed them. Let's stop. Let's say no to the federal government on this. Let's step back as a educational community and create structures, create committees, create task forces to really get together and come up with solutions that will result in reasonable reform for our schools and for our kids, and targeted reform. The reform that East Lyme needs is not the same reform that Bridgeport needs. Let's recognize that and not try to fix this system with a one-fix-suits-everybody mentality. It's not necessary, it's cumbersome, and it's really hurting kids in the end.
Dr. James Lombardo is superintendent of East Lyme Public Schools. He's going to be leaving that position after 30 years in the job next year. He's spent some 43 years in education, and we've been talking about a letter that he wrote to Governor Malloy and Commissioner Pryor and others. Superintendent, first of all, thank you very much for your time and for giving us so much time to speak with us about this important topic today. I truly appreciate it. Tonight, Where We Live is hosting an event with a panel of teachers, and we're inviting all teachers to join us here at our studios in Asylum Hill at 6:30. We'll be talking about what it's like to be a teacher in this era of standardized testing and education reform. If you want to find out more and learn how to RSVP, go to our website, WNPR.org. Coming up next, we'll talk to Dr. Alveda King, niece of Martin Luther King Jr., about her upcoming trip to Connecticut, where she'll be talking about civil rights of the past and present. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Dr. Alveda King is the niece of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and she's the director of African American Outreach for Priests for Life and Gospel of Life Ministries. She's coming to Connecticut to take part in a Yale event called Conversation About Civil Rights Then and Now. King is, in many ways, as controversial as her famous uncle was in the 1960s, if not as well known. And the controversy stems from her views on abortion. She sees abortion as a civil rights issue, one in which she says she's advocating for unborn children. It's a stance that puts her squarely at odds with many who have followed in the footsteps of Dr. Martin Luther King. Dr. Alveda King joined us by phone. Welcome to Where We Live.
I am so glad to join you and your listening audience. Thank you, John.
Now, you're speaking at a Yale event called Conversation About Civil Rights Then and Now. So first, from your perspective, what has changed between then and now in the civil rights movement?
What I enjoy about such a conversation, we have the advantage of going back several generations and then moving forward into the 21st century. Generally, civil rights initially in the 1800s, say 1900s, just on now into this century, we were dealing with the issues of skin color, whether or not people were discriminated against because of the color of their skin. Of course, we know my uncle's famous words, and I have a dream. He wanted us to be judged by the content of our character and not the color of our skin. Now, in the 21st century, I am a voice for human rights and civil rights for all human beings, from conception or fertilization until natural death. So that means no abortion, no euthanasia of the sick or the elderly, killing those who are sick prematurely or the elderly. And so human rights and human dignity, my uncle, Martin Luther King Jr., Uncle ML, said in his 1967 Christmas sermon, just a few months before he died, when we learn to regard the human personality, we won't kill anybody.
How in your work and in your life, did you decide that civil rights and rights for those who have not yet been born or for the elderly would be part of this civil rights conversation? It's not something that many people, frankly, who have been part of the civil rights movement founded by your uncle have taken part in. Give me a sense as to why you went down this path and why you feel so strongly about this being a part of the civil rights movement.
I am 63 years old. It was a natural progression for me. My grandfather rescued me from abortion in 1950. My mother wanted to have a DNC because abortion was illegal, but my grandfather told her no, that he had seen me in a dream. I had secret abortions that I did not tell my family about initially, and I was going to have another abortion in the mid-70s. I told my grandfather, and he said, honey, they're lying to you. That's not a lump of flesh. That's my great-grandchild. So I grew up in a family that included Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., even though Planned Parenthood in 1966 tried to offer him the Maggie or the Margaret Sanger Award after his founder. He did not attend that ceremony. He did not write that speech. His wife went and read a speech that someone else wrote. And just pretty much like Mrs. Laura Bush and Mrs. Barbara Bush, who have supported the pro-choice or pro-abortion agenda, but their husbands did not. That was the case with Martin and Coretta. And so I grew up with the men in my family especially being on guard for the sanctity of life, my own daddy. And so it was a natural progression that after I became born again in 1983 that I would embrace that same thing. And from a legal viewpoint, you know, a woman does have a choice of what she does with her body. The baby is not her body. Where is the lawyer for the baby to protect his or her human rights and his or her civil rights?
The thing, though, that I'm sure many people who are listening in our audience would say is you had the choice a number of times in your life, at least twice, one in which you made the decision to have an abortion, one in which you made the decision not to have an abortion, but with safe, legal abortions available to women today.
Let me just finish and say
many women would say, why would you, having had that opportunity already to make those choices, why would you want to take away my right to make the very same choices that you've made?
Well, this is the answer. Women ask me that, and they yell at me sometimes. I say, ma'am, you have a right to have breast cancer. You have a right to have cervical cancer. You have a right to have strokes and heart attacks. All that's attached to this, and they're not telling you this. I don't want to help you make that choice to hurt yourself. I don't want to help you hurt yourself because I know the harmful impacts. I suffered many of them myself, physically, mentally, emotionally. And so I just don't think it's my job to help hurt women and make women sick. And, you know, hundreds of women die from abortions, from legal abortions, and this is not back alley. This is today where it's legal in America, up to 9 months in some places.
A last thing for you. You've been critical about Planned Parenthood. That organization, while known by many as supporting women's rights to abortion, also has, since its founding in the 1920s by Margaret Sanger, it has helped to keep many women from having unintended pregnancies by use of contraceptives, by trying to help women get around this problem that many, many women face of trying to have a sexually active life but not wanting to have children at certain points in their life. Your criticism of Planned Parenthood about their abortion record notwithstanding, do you not think that they've done some good at keeping women from having unintended pregnancies or having down the road abortions, which I know obviously you don't want to see them have?
The good that may be there is just outdistanced and so far outweighed by the harm. Planned Parenthood does not love women. Planned Parenthood loves the money that women bring to them to support these decisions that could be circumvented with healing and nurturing efforts. And those efforts are out there, and Planned Parenthood does not want a woman to know what her genuine options are.
Dr. Alveda King, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it, and safe travels to Connecticut.
Thank you so much for this opportunity.
To find out more about our teachers panel happening tonight at our Asylum Hill headquarters in Hartford, just go to our website, wnpr.org. I hope to see you there. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.